Hi, this is Ben Lowell, and this is Back to the Bible Canada with Dr. John Neufeld. And today we begin a brand new series called Jesus, Our Sacrifice. So let's turn in our Bibles to Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 to 7, as Dr. Neufeld brings us a message titled, The True Sanctuary of God.
There are facsimiles, and there's the real thing. Copies and the original. There's the actual, there's the replica. Now, historians know a great deal about this. Any archaeologist wants to know if what he has just or she has just discovered is authentic. And they know the difference between a copy of a manuscript and the original. Artists know about this as well. There are representations of a Van Gogh, for example, and then there is the original, the one that Van Gogh actually painted. And when you look at the original and examine it closely, you can see the actual brushstrokes that were laid down by the master. There's something about an original that fascinates all of us. We all deem an original to be of far greater value than a copy. You know, in the automotive world, let's say that you have an original old car. It means that the parts are all original, just the way the manufacturer made it. And there are rules as to how many parts can be after the original and still you can call the car an original. So here's a question. Would you pay the same money for a knockoff as you would for an original high-end watch, for example? Of course you wouldn't. Now, in the spiritual world, the talk of an original and a copy is also a matter of discussion. And that's really important within certain religious groups. As an example, they call themselves Christians, but don't hold to the original teachings of the apostles and the prophets or to the cornerstone Jesus, who's fully man and fully God. But what if they deny that and yet they call themselves Christians? Many of us would not even call that a copy. We'd call that a clever forgery. But let's shift gears. Let's make a distinction between a symbol and the thing that it symbolizes. Let's say that you have a religious tradition in which, you know, somewhere in the building housed for worship, there exists an altar. Now, here's the question. Are you to understand that this altar is the actual place on earth where God is to be approached, or is it just a symbol of a true altar in heaven? Well, that's an important question. That is, do religious symbols merely represent a spiritual reality, or are they the actual reality themselves? Do you see the importance of that? Let's see if I can give an example. I know of a great many people who wear around their neck either a cross or a crucifix. Answer the following question. Is that object simply a reminder of the true cross, or is that cross around your neck actually a spiritual power itself? That is, does the cross or the crucifix actually have power, or is it merely a reminder of the power of the cross? Is it a symbol, or is it the real thing? That's a very important question. For if it's only a symbol, then it will force you back to consider what Christ has accomplished and encourage you to think about the original cross. But if you think it's more, you'll begin to imagine the object has power in and of itself. In that case, you'll not be thinking about the cross of Jesus, but you'll imagine that the cross or the crucifix around your neck is like a magic talisman that can ward off evil. You see what I'm saying? I'm arguing that if you think the cross around your neck has power in and of itself, that very cross has become an idol. It's become something that has replaced the original. For you, it has become a kind of a god, or at least a spiritual item. And that view denies the original cross. Do you see how important is this question? Now, why am I mentioning this? Because as we're going to see, the book of Hebrews is a book in which Jewish Christians are being asked to compare the priestly ministry of Jesus with a priestly ministry that existed in that day in the physical temple in Jerusalem. So which is greater? And more than that, is one a symbol of a greater reality, or is the one a reality in and of itself? Is one merely a shadow awaiting the substance who is Christ, or is the first one a reality in itself? After all, there's a difference between a shadow and the substance, between a copy and the reality. So let's read Hebrews 8, 1 to 7. Now the point of what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. Now, the book of Hebrews is about the supremacy of Jesus. It was written to Jewish Christians of the first century who were tempted to abandon Christ and revert back to Judaism. And the reason this was a temptation was because of increasing persecution against Christians. I won't repeat the entire argument of the book, but notice the first phrase of verse 1 of our chapter. The point of what we are saying is this, and so at this juncture of the book, the writer is about to remind his readers of the main point of everything that he's written to them thus far. And what's the point? We have such a high priest, that's the point. We have a high priest who serves at the true tabernacle as opposed to the one that serves at the tabernacle, which is a shadow or a type of one that is true. So let's compare the earthly high priest to the high priestly office of Jesus. Let's look again at verse 1. Now, the point of what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. So where's Jesus right now? Well, of course, being God, we might say, isn't he omnipresent? Well, yes, he is. But we're speaking of Christ's high priestly ministry. This high priest Jesus, as opposed to the high priest in Jerusalem, this Jesus is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. I put it that way because the words, the majesty in heaven, that refers to the Father. Jesus the Son, as high priest, occupies the seat at the right hand of the Father. Now, when you read that, you might think of how contentious such a statement actually was. Do you remember? Jesus was on trial before the Jewish Sanhedrin, the Jewish religious and ruling council in Jerusalem, and he's being questioned by the high priest, who is becoming increasingly agitated. Well, I'm reading Matthew 26, 62-65. And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent, and the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you're the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said so, but I tell you from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy." So, why is what Jesus has just said considered blasphemy? Well, the answer is that the right hand of God is the place of infinite power and glory. To be seated at God's right hand is to be made equal with God. But now, as the book of Hebrews has been written, Jesus has already been condemned by the Sanhedrin, and then he's been hung on a cross, then he conquered death itself, then he rose bodily from the tomb, then he proved himself alive to his disciples and to many others, and then he ascended into heaven. And he does so for two reasons. Reason number one is because he's already told his disciples that unless he does so, he will not send the Spirit. And reason number two is that he must now take the position or take his seat at the right hand of the Father and rule and reign over all things. Now, in the ancient world, kings sat down when they received or entertained subjects. Subjects stood, kings sat. To sit was to rule. And says the writer of Hebrews, now that Jesus has ascended into heaven, he has sat down. Verse 2, a minister of the holy places in the true tent that the Lord set up and not man. Did you notice the phrase in the holy places? The tabernacle on earth had two holy places. There was the holy place in which were housed the table of bread of the presence, the altar of incense, and the mass of candelabra, which symbolized that God was the only true light. And then another room after that, the Holy of Holies, which housed the Ark of the Covenant, and that Ark represented the presence of God himself. Now, according to Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, when Jesus sat down, he ministered or he ruled in the holiest place of all, the true tent or the true tabernacle or even the true temple. That is, the tabernacle on earth was never the ultimate tabernacle. It was a holy place only because of what it represented. It was but a symbol of the real place. And that, of course, is the place of genuine holiness. And that, of course, leads to some questions about whether there exists a grand tabernacle in heaven, but I'll keep that question aside for now. But that leads us to a more important question right now. What do we make of all the religious symbols? I know many of us will say, well, I come from a church tradition that doesn't have symbols, but you do. You have baptism and the Lord's Supper. Is that a symbol or is it the real thing? Sometimes the church has lost their way on that question.
God has graced Back to the Bible Canada with incredible opportunities, and this ministry rises to the occasion thanks to your gracious support. Your financial gifts enable Back to the Bible Canada to create Bible teaching programs around the world that are being sought after for the precise reason that they are faithful to teaching the Bible. Beyond these daily programs, your support has ensured a growing number of Bible teaching books and resources continue to be translated and distributed throughout much of South Asia. Your support targets the spiritual hunger in Canada, but it also feeds the need in other nations. Thank you for your generosity. We want to encourage you and extend our deepest gratitude. Your gifts are touching the world. Please consider offering a gift this month at backtothebible.ca or call us at 1-800-663-2425.
Just because something is a symbol and not the reality itself, well, that doesn't mean it's unimportant. Spiritual symbols are important. I mean, one of those symbols for Christians today is the sacrament or the ordinance of the Lord's Supper. The bread is not the literal flesh of Christ, nor is the wine the literal blood of Christ. But that doesn't mean the symbol isn't important, nor that it wasn't given to us by God. And that was also true in the ancient tabernacle. Notice when we got to the end of verse 2 that the tabernacle itself was set up by man, and the true tabernacle in heaven is set up by God. But just because the tabernacle on earth was built by human beings, that doesn't mean it was a human idea. No, it was God's idea. The symbol of the tabernacle was to play a significant role in Israel's understanding of God and of themselves. Very well, let's continue to read, and now I'm reading Hebrews 8, verses 3 and 4. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices, thus it was necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. So let's start with what might be confusing in verse 4. How is it true that if Jesus was on earth, that is, if he had not ascended into heaven, that he would not be a priest at all? So you might wonder about that. Does that mean that the ascension of Jesus was necessary for Jesus to fulfill his priestly role? Well, yes. And here let's follow this line of thought. First, every priest offers gifts and sacrifices. So if you read through the book of Leviticus, the book of the law dedicated to the duty of priests, you're going to find out that the first 5.5 chapters are devoted to the 5 major offerings the priest offered before God. They were the burnt offering, the grain offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, and the guilt offering. Priests were appointed to offer gifts of thanksgiving and sacrifices for sins. That was their duty. And of course, at the time of the writing of Hebrews, that was still ongoing. But if Jesus were on earth, he would not be a priest, and that for at least 2 reasons. The first, something that the writer of Hebrews has already dealt with, is that all earthly priests needed to be from the tribe of Levi. Jesus was from the tribe of Judah. But in our passage, the reason Jesus would not have been a priest is that there are priests already today offering the sacrifices. In other words, he would only be doing a redundancy. We come then to the very important verse 5. They, priests today, serve a copy and a shadow of heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." Well, I need to say here that there are a great many critics of the book of Hebrews, and the criticism goes as follows. Hebrews, say the critics, is not a book that reflects Jewish thinking. This is Greek thinking. So why do they say that? Well, because of this verse. You see, some Greek philosophers spoke about the real and the ideal. The real were those things that existed on earth, and the ideal were the perfect representation of those things in the spiritual realm. Well, the Hebrews never thought that way because when God created the world, he said it was good and not a facsimile of some greater spiritual reality. But, for example, Plato taught that everything in the natural world is derived from the forms, but that these forms were an imitation or an impression of something that was perfect and absolute and eternal. And so this imperfect earth is a facsimile of something that exists in a perfect spiritual realm. Well, Hebrews, on the other hand, would have agreed with the hymn writer who said that this is my Father's world. See, the physical world is the good work of the Creator. But on the other hand, the Greeks would say any earthly joy is but the world of shadows. And so for Plato, if you occupy yourself with thoughts of this world and then you die, well, you drive rivets between, you know, your body and, you know, this world, and you'll never escape to pure spirit. Well, the Hebrews, on the other side, they believe that we were both body and spirit, and that eternally we're going to be bodily resurrected. You know, the Greeks thought that was nonsense. You see the difference. And that brings us to verse 5. Is the writer of Hebrews betraying that he's been influenced by Greek thinking when he says that the earthly tabernacle is a copy or a shadow of the true tent, or perhaps even the ideal tent in heaven? So in order to understand the writer of Hebrews, we should ask this question. Does the Old Testament give us the idea that the earthly tabernacle is merely a shadow of heavenly things? We note that the last half of the book of Exodus gives detailed instructions, not only how to build the tabernacle, but also detailed instructions as to how to build every single article of furniture in that tabernacle, everything from the Ark of the Covenant to the table of the bread of the presence, the golden lampstand, and so forth. And then Moses is told why, and it's in Exodus 25, verse 40. "And see that you make them after the pattern for them, which is being shown you on the mountain." That is, God himself gave detailed instructions as to how this was to be built. Now, of course, this means that God had very specific reasons for wanting everything to be precisely the way it was. No item in the tabernacle was thrown in for mere art or creativity. Everything was to showcase a spiritual and eternal truth. So what does that mean? Well, up till now, I've not defined how the tabernacle is a copy of something in heaven, but let's do that now. Are we to understand that there's a literal tabernacle in heaven that looks greater and grander than the one that Moses built on earth? Or let me put it another way, is there a literal counterpart to the earthly tabernacle in heaven, a better one? You know, interestingly enough, that idea came not from the Greeks, but from the Jewish rabbis after Christ. Some of them speculated that the reason Moses was given such detail concerning the tabernacle is that he was literally shown the tabernacle in heaven, and so he was called to build a representation of it on earth. Now, in my view, that's silly. There's nothing in the Bible that indicates that there's a tabernacle in heaven with literally a holy of holies. Since the Bible doesn't speak of this matter, it does no good to imagine what is and is not in heaven. And for my part, it seems to me that the shadow or the copy that's spoken of in verse 5 means that what happened in the earthly tabernacle, all of it foreshadowed or pointed to what Christ would accomplish on the cross. That is, it was symbolic, a symbol of what was to come. Let's see if I can say it another way. All those sacrifices that were offered, first in the tabernacle, then later in the temple, all of that anticipated the cross. See, I don't think the real, the ideal, the true, and the authentic means that there's a perfect tabernacle in heaven. Instead, I think it means that every activity in the tabernacle was eventually fulfilled in Christ's suffering. Even the Holy of Holies that indicated or symbolized that God was holy and that no unclean thing or person could stand in his presence and that blood would have to be shed, all of that was about the cross. And so there's not Greek idealism here. Rather, that the temple is a type, a symbol of the cross. Let's go to verses 6 and 7. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. Now these two verses actually complete a thought that was begun in verse 4. If Jesus were merely an earthly priest, he wouldn't be a priest at all. We don't need more earthly priests. What we do need is a heavenly one. And verse 6 says that Christ has done what no earthly priest could do. He has brought in a better, more excellent covenant than the first one, better promises, a better arrangement between God and human beings. And then the final statement. The old covenant isn't perfect, but it did look forward to the arrival of that which is perfect. Symbols and the things they represent. How often even Christians today fall down and worship the symbol rather than allow the symbol to remind us of that which we must truly worship. And that was the problem with the early Christian Hebrews. Stop thinking of the earthly high priest and the earthly temple, that it's the holiest place on earth. It's a symbol. The cross of Christ is what that symbol pointed to, and that's the only real thing. And so if you wear a cross around your neck, or you have a picture of Jesus somewhere, or when you partake in the Lord's table, an institution given to us by none other than Jesus himself, don't you dare stop at the symbol. Let the symbol take you to the reality. When you eat the bread, let the eating of the bread transform your heart to gaze on Christ's broken body, and let the wine take you to the blood that flowed at the cross. Remember that our high priest has become our perfect sacrifice. Don't you dare worship symbols. Worship Christ.
John, thanks so much for your message today and the series. Let me ask you, you know, the cross as a symbol has been used for centuries, and yet now I dare say it's become less of a symbol of Christ's sacrifice and more even of a fashion statement. Is this part of the concern of symbols in general and what symbols can become or represent?
Yeah, isn't that a good question? Ben, thank you for that. I mean, it just seems to me that the symbols that can direct our thoughts and lead us to contemplate more deeply what Christ has done for us can be also those very symbols that lead us in a very, very ungodly direction. Isn't that a fascinating thing? This is what symbols actually do, and therefore we're always required to keep our focus on the main thing and the real thing, and of course, which is Jesus crucified for us. So, you know, I would say if a cross leads you to think more about that, get involved in that, and if not, just stay away as much as you can.
Thanks so much, John. And remember to join us again tomorrow as we continue our series, Jesus, Our Sacrifice, right here on Back to the Bible Canada, Bible teaching you can trust. We don't all need a passport to be a missionary. In Canada, the mission field has come to us. The current immigration pattern in Canada presents the opportunity to engage in cross-cultural missions without learning a new language, packing a suitcase, or hopping on a plane. We can simply look out our window and open our door. But how do we effectively share the gospel with our new neighbors? In support of Back to the Bible Canada's International Ministry Month, a new resource called Missions at Our Door has been created, and we want to share it with you this month as our free gift. It's a practical guide that walks you through some of the steps to welcome newcomers and introduce them to the good news of Jesus. Request Missions at Our Door as our gift. And if you're able, perhaps consider how you might support the growing global ministry of Back to the Bible Canada. Call us at 1-800-663-2425 or visit backtothebible.ca.